No, that's, sorry.
All rise. The judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. Court calls the case of United States versus Master Sergeant Anthony M. De Silva, number ACM 39599. In today's oral argument, we consider whether specifications one and two of charge one are void for vagueness because appellant was not given fair notice of what the prohibited conduct of making sexual advances is, and that such conduct is subject to criminal liability. And whether the military judge abused his discretion in allowing parts of ML's and A1C AS's unsworn statements pursuant to RCM 1001A. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 7 minutes.
Very well. You may proceed when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, members of the court. Judge Posh, pleasure to see you again. Judge Lewis, Judge Johnson, I don't know if we have met, but it's a pleasure to be here. Your Honor, my name is William Casera, and along with Captain Campbell, we represent the appellant, Master Sergeant De Silva. As the court has said, we are here to argue two issues. With the court's permission, I would like to start through them in the order that they have been announced, and start with issue one. Your Honor, on page 460 of the record of trial, the military judge said, quote, "Again, we're not going to know upon what theory Master Sergeant De Silva was acquitted of those specs or, alternatively, found guilty of making sexual advances in violation of a lawful general regulation." Respectfully, Your Honors, if the military judge doesn't know, the government hasn't been able to pinpoint in their brief what the appellant was convicted of. How is the appellant to know what he was accused of and what he now stands convicted of?
So, Mr. Casera,
yes, Your Honor.
Is that comment by the military judge just a comment on a general verdict rather than a comment about whether appellant had fair notice that his conduct was prohibited?
Well, I don't know why the military judge made the comment, but I think certainly one can look at it. And, you know, Your Honor, I was analogizing it sort of in an abstract way to a Walters issue where the court says, you know, where the accuser is charged with committing three or four delineated offenses, and the panel comes back and says, we find him guilty except for the words "on diverse occasions." There is a requirement under the law that the appellant be given, or the accused be given, notice of which specific instance he was convicted of. The problem in this case is that the accused was not put on notice of what he was accused of. In fact, not only did the government Not only does the regulation not specify what sexual advances are, the government did not delineate in the specifications what he was accused of.
Because the sexual advances could have been conduct or it could have been words, is that?
I have no idea, Judge. Yes, it could have been. It could have been, and the problem, Judge Posh, is not only could it have been conduct or words, but in the 120 specifications, where the government did specifically delineate the allegations that, of which he was accused and the method by which he allegedly committed those offenses, there were two or three instances of a verbal advance, two or three instances of touching, and we don't know whether the panel found him guilty of, we don't know if he was charged with all of those as a sexual advance, and we don't know if the panel found him guilty of one, two, three, four, five, or six of those offenses.
Do we need to know what the panel found him guilty of, or do we need to know whether appellant was on fair notice?
That's correct, Judge. That is the emphasis. The issue of whether or not we know what he was convicted of really goes more towards the prejudice prong of the fair notice issue. So in the specifications involving ML, and I'll just do a very brief recitation of the facts. The court has the record of trial. The appellant was a recruiter, and he made certain comments to ML that were charged as 120 offenses. And those comments are, you know, listed in my brief. No need for me to go through them unless the court wishes to ask specific questions about them. There is a sting operation set up. ML sends pretext messages to the appellant, and the appellant shows up at a hotel. He is arrested. After ML's allegation, as frequently happens in these cases, OSI contacts his other recruits, and AS says that at some point after she had graduated, that appellant kissed her on the mouth. In specifications 1 and 2 of charge 1, the government charged appellant with violating a lawful general regulation. The regulation in question states that personnel, quote, shall not engage or try to engage in the following activities within the context of a relationship covered by paragraph 2-3, 2.32. The ATC, and then one of those is making sexual advances. The AETCI, and for ease of clarity, so I'm just going to call it the regulation, because if I try to say that a zillion times, I'm never going to be able to remember, does not define making sexual advances. The military judge did not instruct the panel on what sexual advances meant. The standard of review is whether a statute provides adequate notice of what is criminally prohibited is a de novo review. When void for vagueness is challenged for the first time on appeal, this court applies a plain error analysis. Due process requires that fair notice that an act is forbidden and subject to criminal sanction. Fair notice uses a reasonableness standard. Void for vagueness means that no criminal responsibility if the accused cannot reasonably understand why the conduct is prohibited. Our Superior Court in U.S. v. Vaughn stated that the sources of fair notice in the military are federal law, state law, military case law, military custom and usage, and military regulations. Importantly, the way to determine if an accused should be reasonably aware of the criminality of his conduct is through other sources of law or through the history of the offense. That's the Boyette case. None of the Vaughn sources of fair notice gave the appellant notice of what constituted making sexual advances. As Judge Posh says, we don't know if it's oral comments, we don't know if it is physical acts. We don't know what making sexual advances mean. Does the prohibited conduct include only oral statements, physical contact, or both? Must the oral statement specifically refer to sexual conduct, or does innuendo suffice? For example, if the appellant had called ML, or after, you know, perhaps they have a relationship and calls her and says, come over at 2 o'clock, and that's sort of a code word for them, that they are going to have a sexual relationship at that time. Are the words, come over at 2 o'clock, criminal?
And if there was other evidence that, in fact, what an appellant meant by those words was sexual intercourse, then maybe. But what you're saying is we don't know because...
We don't know.
Maybe. The words themselves, you're looking at the word. In other words, should we just look at the words themselves or the context in which the words are uttered to determine sexual advance?
Oh, I think we have to look at both, Judge. But I think in this case, we just don't know. Does the prohibited contact include in-person conversations, text messages, communication via social media, or something else? If the conduct is physically impossible, if they are engaged in dirty talk, and the appellant is a recruiter in California, and the recruit is in South Carolina, is that making of a sexual advance? Does it require a time frame when that sexual conduct will take place? We simply don't know.
Well, why is Pope not military case law to provide classified
status? Oh, it is, and I'll certainly be addressing Pope, Your Honor. I promise. I can do so right now, or I can, I'm getting there very quickly.
Go ahead and address Pope now, please.
Okay. Well, in fact, I was next on my outline, so. The difference between this case and Pope is very simple. CAF considered whether that particular regulation, recruiting procedures, gave the appellant some fair notice of what was an improper, whether he was engaging in any verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature that creates an intimidating, hostile, or work environment. The difference in Pope is that there is a significant amount of case law that addresses what constitutes a hostile work environment. The difference in Pope is that in that particular case, there was a significant amount of evidence that the accused, had been briefed numerous times on what constituted a hostile work environment. The difference in Pope is that the regulation gave specific examples of what can constitute a hostile work environment. None of those are present in this case. In fact, while the government says Pope, decides the case in their favor, I would argue that Pope is actually favorable to the appellant, because in Pope, the court said, while a non-existent list is not required, one can certainly surmise that what CAF is saying is a non-existent list, exhaustive list is not required, but surely some examples are. And that's what the Vaughn case says, that the appellant has to be given some fair notice. None of the examples of fair notice that the court used in Pope are present in the appellant's case.
I'd like you to talk about the 2983 forms that were signed by A1C, AS, and ML, and particularly with attention to appellant signature at
yes,
the
sir.
Bottom approving.
Yes,
those,
sir. Which said, for lack of a better, I'm sorry, Judge Posh, do you have a question? Okay. I think for lack of a better term, Judge Lewis, what it really says is that he is witnessing their signature, that he is saying that they have completed some form, been given some information, but nothing in that form indicates that he has been given that sort of information. But again, even if he did, it doesn't define what making sexual advances is.
So you think that the 2983 form itself is defective because in block 7G, it says the words, make sexual advances towards, or seek or accept sexual advances or favors from a recruiter trainer. You think that for A1C, AS, and ML to be on proper notice that their conduct is also prohibited, there needs to then be a list of things sexual advances?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that the form is defective. What I am saying is that the appellant witnessed or, authorized their signature. There is no indication at all that the appellant was given any further or briefing or that he even knew what was on the form.
Does the block not say that he is approving the form? Could they have not written this Department of Defense form to say witnessed if they meant witness?
I don't know what approving means, Judge, quite candidly. I think it,
Do you not think that it means that if there is a prior relationship that a recruit has that meets an exception, and they would fill that in block 8, that appellant would be approving that prior relationship, and in the absence of any prior relationship, would be leaving that block blank?
I think he is approving that they have received that information.
Counsel, I'm looking at that form. It just happens to be in front of us here, and you probably don't have the benefit of it, but we have in front of you, but I'm looking at the very first block. It talks about the recruiter also acknowledging that it's prohibited, I guess, to develop, attempt to develop, or conduct a personal, intimate, or sexual relationship with a recruiter or trainer. I can't revisit why the government charged this case the way they did, and that's not our role or yours really either, for that matter, the government. But it seems to me that, is there a case to be made that you could clarify what sexual advance means by looking at other acknowledgments that are on this form?
Your Honor, I think that a case can be made that the appellant may have violated some other regulation by his conduct. The question is not whether he violated some other regulation that he was not charged. The question is whether he was put on fair notice that what he did constituted making sexual advances. That's the difference, Your Honor. The specifications do not state what appellant's sexual advances were. The appellant was convicted of the three abusive sexual contact specifications. So those can't be the sexual advances, although the government in their brief says that it could have been one of the non-consensual acts. He was acquitted of those. The government says we don't know what he was, why the panel acquitted him. Well, respectfully, if the military judge doesn't know, the government doesn't know, then the appellant certainly does not know what he was accused of and what he now is convicted of. Your Honor, subject to any further questions from the members of the court as it relates to assignment of error one, I would like to address assignment of error two.
Please proceed.
Members of the court. Thank you. The military judge abused his discretion in allowing parts of ML's and AIC's unsworn statement pursuant to RCM 1001 alpha. Prior to the sentencing portion of the court-martial, the appellant's defense counsel objected to the unsworn statements which the government offered in accordance with RCM 1001 alpha.
I just want to hold you there a second. You said the government offered them as if the trial counsel was offering them as sentencing evidence. Is it fair to say that they were offered under 1001 capital A, and that's how the military judge took them?
My brief says capital A, so I'm just reading alpha.
Right, so they are not evidence in aggravation or victim impact offered by the prosecution. It was just the trial counsel facilitated getting them to the military judge.
The question of whether or not they are evidence is actually left undecided at this point under, I think it's Hamilton, where CAF said we're not going to reach the issue of whether or not they're evidence.
I'm not sure if that's your question. I'm getting at that they are the victim's Article 6 right to be reasonably heard, offered essentially by the victim. They just happened in this case to have the senior trial counsel present them as court exhibits to the military judge. They're not part of the prosecution's sentencing case.
I'm not sure that's correct, Judge. I think that they are this bizarre anomaly that Hamilton discusses. I also think that it's kind of a distinction without a difference in the sense that the government still controls the flow of evidence. And once the appellant was acquitted of the 120 offenses, the government certainly could have said, we're not going to ask the court to consider these because the information in them relates to offenses for which he was not charged. But whether the evidence was introduced, admitted by the trial counsel, the special victims counsel, the bottom line is still the same, that they reference offenses for which the appellant was acquitted.
Mr. Casera, I think what you're pointing out is perhaps the awkwardness of, frankly, the case law in this area. We say it's not evidence. So in the vernacular, what business does the prosecutor have putting those before the court? That's kind of your point. That should be the responsibility of the victim or the victim's counsel, is what I think I hear you saying.
Well, I think there's two problems, Judge. The first is that it had no business coming before the court, but secondly, that it exceeded the scope of the testimony for which the appellant was found guilty.
The substance, procedure. The substance.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes, sir. So here is the dichotomy in this case, members of the court. The military judge found that ML and AS qualified as crime victims under 1001 Big A, even though this is an Article 92 situation because, quote, they did suffer some direct, at least emotional harm as a result of the sexual advances of Master Sergeant De Silva. Well, the problem, Judge, is that the military judge, that he admitted that he didn't know what the appellant was convicted of. So when he says that they suffered a direct harm as a result of those offenses for which he was convicted would seem contradictory with his prior statement that he doesn't know what he was convicted of as it relates to the Article 92 offenses. The Civilian Defense Council renewed his objection and with regards to AS's statement that, quote, Master Sergeant De Silva violated me, he violated my body, he violated my trust, he did it without my consent, because the appellant was convicted of that offense. The standard of review, as this court knows, is de novo. The UCMJ gives victims of UCMJ offenses the right to be reasonably heard at a sentencing hearing. That is the Hamilton case. RCM 1001 Alpha Bravo 1 says a crime victim is an individual who has suffered direct physical, emotional, or pecuniary harm as a result of the commission of offense to which the accused has been found guilty. And RCM 1 goes on to further say that a victim impact consists of any financial, social, psychological, or medical impact on the victim directly relating to or arising from the offense to which the accused has been found guilty. It must directly relate to or arise from the offense to which the accused has been found guilty. That is Hamilton. Of particular note, Your Honors, I would like the court to consider is that unlike Hamilton and Barker, this was a member's case. That is a significant difference in this case. This was not a bench trial. The United States Air Force, .ML or AS, is the victim of appellant's violation of a general regulation. Parts of ML and AS's unsworn statement exceeded the scope of the permissible permissible victim impact information. Hamilton is clear.
Counsel, sorry, Judge.
Well,
name it. Let me go back. Well, naming the individual in the specification is certainly not dispositive.
It is not.
As to whether the individual is a victim, how should it factor into our analysis?
Well, Judge, I think the best analogy I can give you is an accused is brought into OSI, and he says, "I didn't have sex with her. Didn't do anything with her," and then is confronted later and says, "Well, I did have sex, but it was consensual." The accused is charged with a 107 offense for lying to Special Agent Smith of OSI. To take the government's argument to its logical absurdity would be to say that OSI Agent Smith gets to come into court and say, "I am the victim of the false official statement, and therefore, and I now have a lower opinion of Airman because Senior Airman Jones lied to me when I first asked him." That is an absurdity to which this court cannot extend victim impact statements. Hamilton is clear, as I said. So the military judge erred in allowing AS to tell the panel that appellant had violated her body and that ML wondered every time whether every senior NCO would try and have sex with young and impressionable airmen. The military judge's error in this case substantially influenced the judge sentenced. The government sentencing case was weak and the defense sentencing case was strong. The merits case was strong as the appellant was acquitted of several offenses. The focus should be on the offense, on the strength of the defense case. The defense case was so strong that the appellant was acquitted of several cases. On the sentencing side, aside from the unsworn, which exceeded the scope of 1000 and Alpha, the government only offered his personal data sheet and 14 exceptional EPRs and a letter of counseling related to a failed physical fitness test. The defense sentencing case was strong because of the number and the strength of the witnesses, which is I address in AOE 4. I don't need to go through them all before the court again. These two statements were the linchpin of the government sentencing case. Their statements mattered more to the panel than the government other evidence, and the quality of their statements influenced the sentence, leading to an inappropriately severe sentence.
Were they argued by the trial counsel as if they were evidence improperly?
They were not. They were not.
So how does that factor into how important they were to the sentencing case versus the evidence that was before the members that they found him guilty of making sexual advances towards these
and
two
women?
And
if this were a bench trial, Judge Lewis, I think that we could safely assume that the military judge properly applied the law and that he did not take those into consideration for anything more than what they are.
So did the military judge then have a duty to further instruct the members beyond the instruction that he gave about the victim unsworn statement?
Did he need to tell the
members how to use it in some different manner?
The military's judge's obligation was to not allow that testimony into or those statements into evidence or into the case in the first place.
But if we assume for a second that they are victims and that it's beyond just the Air Force as a victim for a 92 offense, if we assume that for a moment and we get to the actual content of the statements, does the military judge have an obligation at some point to give an instruction?
Your Honor, the first thing that occurs to me is if I don't understand Hamilton, I'm not sure that I understand exactly what the scope of 1001 Alpha is as it relates to victim impact statements. The CAF has expressed some unknowingness as to exactly where these things, you know, where these uniforms fall under the law. I don't know that any instruction would do anything more than confuse the panel more than they were already confused.
Thank you.
Counsel, just as a thought, is there any case in our jurisprudence where we exclude an unsworn statement? Has that ever been issued? Have we ever had any court in the military justice system say we're going to exclude evidence from an unsworn statement?
I don't know of any, Judge. I would say that there's probably two reasons for that. One is if it was excluded, it wouldn't come up as an issue before this court. And two is because they're a relatively new unicorn or a new phenomenon. Your Honor, the last example I would like to give you is a commander calls a soldier in and that soldier is disrespectful to them. He says, stand, or airman, I'm sorry. I've gone back to my Army roots for a second, and says, airman, you stand at attention. And the airman is disrespectful and does not stand at attention. Would allow, under the government's theory, that commander to come into court and say, I now have a lower opinion of airmen because my airman didn't stand at attention when I ordered him to do so. Again, that is an absurdity to which this court cannot extend RCM 1001.
Couldn't the military judge in your example just simply force the commander to articulate why he has suffered some financial, social, psychological, or medical impact as a result of the disrespect?
According to the military judge in this case, apparently not.
But I'd like to stick with your hypothetical.
Okay.
Couldn't the military judge just have that commander on the stand as a basis or a proffer from their counsel to say, tell me why this is victim impact under 1001 big A?
I think he could, absolutely.
And if the person could not demonstrate one of those financial, social, psychological, or medical impact, then the judge would say, that's outside your scope of your right to be reasonably heard.
And would do what the military judge in this case should have done, which is say, I am not going to allow the panel to hear that evidence or hear that information. I keep calling it evidence, and we don't know what it is, but it's not to hear that information. Your Honor, my time is up. Subject to further questions from the members of the court, that concludes the appellant's initial presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Government counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Major Ann Delmar, and together with Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States in today's hearing. This court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case because appellant was on fair notice that his behavior in violation of Article 92 was subject to criminal liability, and because the military judge did not abuse his discretion when admitting victim impact statements during sentencing. So I'll turn first to the first granted issue. The challenge specifications are not unconstitutionally vague, and both specifications provided sufficient notice to appellant that his conduct was subject to criminal sanction. The common meaning of sexual advances was sufficient to put appellant on notice in this case. At the outset, appellant did not raise at any stage of the proceedings a challenge to vagueness in this case. And not only did appellant not challenge the specifications under Article 92 for vagueness, there's nothing in the record to indicate that the appellant was confused or lacked notice of what he had to defend against at trial. A void for vagueness challenge requires inquiry into whether a reasonable person in appellant's position would have known that the conduct at issue was criminal. And the record demonstrates that the appellant was on notice. And the focus of the appellant's defense throughout the trial was on showing that the sexual advances towards ML and AS were consensual. So there was no dispute during trial that this wasn't sexual in nature. There was no dispute that these weren't sexual advances towards the two victims. It was simply that they were consensual, and he put the full force of his argument against the Article 120s, and essentially concedes during findings and during closing argument, so during his opening and closing, that there was certainly fraternization in this case, that there was recruiter misconduct in this case, but it didn't amount to non-consensual relationships.
So I'd like you to explain for each of the two, A1C, AS, and ML, were there behaviors by appellant in the vehicle that were innocuous? And when does he cross the line to making a sexual advance such that an ordinary person would know that that conduct was prohibited?
Yes, Judge Lewis. So for ML in the vehicle, and trial counsel put this in their closing argument abundantly clear. They listed it in a PowerPoint. and they listed out the specific facts that the government found to be the sexual advances and what we were arguing were the sexual advances in this case. And they list out the saying, I want to bang you, grabbing her hand when she said that she was not interested, grabbing her inner thigh, talking about having sex. All of those are overtly sexual behaviors that it was made known to him that this wasn't some sort of friendly interaction that she was okay with, but were blatantly and obviously sexual advances. Same goes for AS. Again, trial counsel put in their closing argument PowerPoint, they addressed it during opening very clearly, that talking about her body, telling her that she was pretty, and then kissing her, all showed sexual advances towards AS. The appellant noted the court's holding in Pope that they direct us also to look at a variety of different sources if we're looking to ensure that the appellant was on notice. And the government disagrees with appellant that those same indicators were not present in this case. So we have AETC instruction 362909, which puts appellant on notice that sexual advances could result in criminal proceedings. And while 2.3.3 does not specifically address or give examples for what that could be, number one, I would say that Pope says that we don't need to give specific examples. And secondly, if you look under that same heading, right above it, there's a paragraph that describes sexual behaviors, sexual relationships, and it gives a variety of examples, such as hand-holding, kissing, caressing, or other sexual activities. Appellant was also on notice from the DD Form 2983, and the government disagrees that it's reasonable to argue that he would not be on notice from that form. He's a seasoned recruiter, he's a master sergeant, whose job is to educate recruits, to answer their questions, to make sure they understand the process, and he signed that his recruit did understand that. His training also put him on notice. Two witnesses took the stand to talk about the fact that through in recruiter schooling in Lackland, or at Lackland, recruiters are taught and there's a stressor put on proper relationships between recruiters and recruitees. Finally, Pope also discusses how any reasonable person in the appellant's shoes would have known that this behavior was criminal, would have known that it was improper, and a reasonable service member in this case would not have had to ponder whether driving a recruit to a remote area and then making sexual advances, telling her he wanted to bang her, telling her he wanted to have sex with her, and grabbing her body would not be prohibited behavior. In the appellant's brief, he also notes that there's no case law that really gives us any indication of what these particular behaviors could be. But the government would disagree with this. The cases that appellant has cited shows that our superior court upholds charges for sexual advances, and specifically in Pope, the charge was that he made verbal and physical advances, but they didn't specify to any degree what that was, and the court upheld those charges when contested on a basis for vagueness.
Would you characterize the behavior in Pope as the same, worse, or on a lower scale than the behavior of appellant in this case that you've described in your argument?
Your Honor, I would describe it as same or lower. For example, one of the charges just had to do with the appellant making a comment about finding, I think it was an eyebrow ring or a nose ring, sexy. And that was the basis for one of the charges. So if anything, I believe the conduct in this case was much more significant. The government didn't hide the ball at all. They addressed specifically what they charged, the one incident for each victim, in both their findings and their closing. And the defense counsel, at no point did they indicate that they weren't aware what they were defending against, but noted that ML flirted with the appellant. The appellant was foolishly took the bait and flirted back. The pretext goes to show a continuation of their talk about sex in the van, and used all the facts to show that there was this consensual sexual behaviors going on. Finally, there was no prejudice, even if this court were to reach a prejudice analysis. The Article 120 offenses in this particular case put the appellant on notice of the specific conduct that the appellant, that the government found to be sexual in nature. So in Pope, they say we can't look at this as sort of a vague, broad, could some appellant have in the future be confused. We look at this specific case, we look at the facts in this specific case, and we ask, would this appellant have been on notice?
That would only apply to the physical contact, not the words, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And then finally, again, the trial counsel's arguments at trial were clear that there was no confusion against what he must defend. And then under that prejudice analysis, it includes what we've talked about on fair notice, case law, the different forms, the regulations, and this appellant's particular training.
What about some of the evidence that came up of appellant's apologies once he was apprehended by law enforcement and drives to the car? Is that at all relevant to show that he was on fair notice? Or is that simply just related to him realizing that going to the hotel, an uncharged offense, was a violation?
Your Honor, the government's position is that is just one more indicator that this particular appellant was aware that his behavior was criminal, was improper. And even the defense used, again, as you mentioned, Your Honor, it's not charged misconduct, but even the defense used it to say this is an indicator of what was going on in that initial interaction that they were following up on. So it's the government's position that that would just be one more indicator that he knew that his conduct, that he was on notice that this conduct was criminal.
I think we're ready for you to move on to the other AOE.
The military judge did not abuse his discretion because ML and AS's unsworn statement and the content therein was proper. Both ML and AS qualified as victims under Article 6B and RCM 1001 capital A, as they suffered direct emotional harm as a result of appellant sexual advances.
So what evidence did the military judge have before him when he made that ruling that they suffered direct emotional harm? Because he hadn't even looked at the court exhibits at this point.
I believe, Your Honor, that he noted that he hadn't been provided the court exhibits, and my reading of the transcript was at that point he was provided the court exhibits. But also during the trial, both victims testified to the harm that had on them at the time. So they were both stressed, they were both scared, they were there was multiple witnesses after the fact for ML, who she called, both the individual at MEPS and then also her mentor, who was her pastor, and she they both described her being in distress and being very upset from this incident. Also, I think it's very foreseeable that these were victims of the offense. As Judge Johnson noticed, set out in the specification doesn't necessarily make them victims, but that's one indicator that the appellant would have that these were victims of the offense. But it also is the category of people that this service regulation that he violated, they've identified as the victims of this offense. Even in the AFI, it talks about how when there's an improper relationship between recruiters, commanders should look at the subordinate and potentially see them as the victim because of the improper power dynamic between recruiters and recruitees. The military judge considered the defense's objection, and he found the information proper under RCM 1000A, and while maintaining that these are unsworn statements were not evidence, an abundance of caution, understanding that CAF has not made a final determination on this matter, he conducted a 403 balancing test. And he did this twice. He did this at the time that the objection was made, and then later he went back, circled back, and made it abundantly clear that he considered this as their right under the law to provide a statement under RCM 1001 capital A, and that he considered the content, the specific objections to the content, with our superior court's ruling in Roblero, understanding there's not this blanket authorization that for information to come in victim impact statements, but that that it needs to be relevant to what the appellant has been found guilty of.
Well, counsel, how is regarding A1CAS's statement about violating her body, how is this not a direct comment on an offense to which appellant was acquitted?
Your Honor, so my response to that is, A, he was, it's the same facts and circumstances that he was found guilty for the 92 specifications. Secondly, it doesn't matter whether he was, we don't know, as the judge pointed out, whether he was found guilty of, as in any case where a mistake of fact as to consent is raised. We don't know whether the members found that it was because he had a mistake of fact or because it was actual consenting. But in this case, it doesn't matter. The victim could feel, even if it was a consensual encounter, could feel violated that this master sergeant, her recruiter, took her out into the middle of nowhere and made sexual advances on her. So even if in the situation they sort of acquiesced to it or they found it to be consensual, that still allows them to provide to the court members how that impacted them.
And counsel, one of the issues that I struggle with is when a judge has a responsibility in an unsworn statement to exclude it or do nothing other than handle it in instructions. And your thoughts on that would be appreciated.
I believe that Roblero is probably one of the few, if only, cases that provide any instruction on that. And I believe that the military judge, if it was blatantly improper testimony to become in front of members, it didn't comport with RCM 1001, it didn't go to an emotional harm that this victim suffered because of this offense, then the military judge would have the authority to exclude it, I believe, under Roblero.
So a question in my mind is, do we look at this case, the issues raised by the appellant is, do we look through the lens of instructional error? There should have been an instruction, and the judge erred in not sua sponte instructing, or was plain error perhaps for not instructing, or on the other hand, is it not evidence, but should it have been excluded, and does it matter? Maybe it doesn't matter which lens we look at it through, but I guess the question is which path is the path that is the right path to?
And Your Honor, I believe under Roblero that the right path would, if it was not appropriate, so in Roblero, the issue was the victim commented on what the sentence should be, and the court found that that was improper. And so I believe there are certain circumstances where it would be proper for the military judge to exclude it, and I don't believe that's the case in this particular case. The military judge also did instruct on the unsworn statement and instructed that the members were free to disregard the statement or give whatever weight they wanted to it, and if they found that it was contradicted by other evidence, they could go ahead and give that weight. So again, if the argument is that the members found that this sexual event was consensual, the members would just as likely be to disregard this victim statement as the military judge had told them they could do if they found it to be contradicted by the evidence in the case.
And then with that thought process, what do you do with the statement by ML, A1C ML,
I have to deal with my integrity and character being attacked. Because as the appellant is raising, that looks a lot like, from the appellant's perspective, I testified, I was cross-examined. As lawyers, we may look at that as, well, that's just another day in court, but the victim is saying, I had to have my integrity trashed at this trial. What does a judge do with that in a victim statement?
In this case, I believe it was proper for the military judge to have admitted that statement, and he did particularly consider that objection and found that it was under Article 6B and RCM 1001A to be a proper statement by the victim. And I believe under Roblero, if the court found that it wasn't, then the judge would have the authority to exclude it. Even if this court finds error and finds the appellant has met his high burden of showing a clear abuse of discretion by the military judge, the statements did not substantially affect the judge sentence in this case.
Before you go on to that, just want to talk about one more statement in ML's written and oral unsworn that's raised in the brief by appellant, dealing with senior NCOs and trying to have sex with young and impressionable airmen. First, was that objected to specifically at trial? And if so, does that matter because there was an overall objection that the entire statement should not come in because they're not victims?
No, that Judge Lewis, that was not objected to at trial. So it's the government's position that this would be that specific comment would be reviewed under plain error. It's the government's position that that is a separate objections to content are considered separately from the objection to whether they qualify as a victim or not and should be considered separately. Secondly, in the appellant's brief, he talks about how that relates to the incident at the hotel and not the incident at the duck pond for which the appellant was charged and convicted. However, at the duck pond, the appellant also talked about wanting to have sex with the victim and wanting to hook up with the victim and pursuing that. And so it was proper victim impact for ML to talk about how that has impacted her view of NCOs in the Air Force as a result.
Thank you. You can go back to whether it's substantially influenced the sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant used his position of trust and authority to prey on the Air Force's newest recruits. Even if the members believe the sexual advances were consensual, as we've discussed, the focus of the victim's statements pertain to how appellant tainted the Air Force for them and their distrust of NCOs. And this is exactly the harm the Air Force seeks to prevent and could have largely argued with or without those victim impact statements. As the court in Pope noted, proper relations between recruiters and recruitees are indispensable in attracting young people to serve the country and maintaining military discipline. Offensive conduct of a sexual nature by recruiters drives potential applicants away and undermines the effectiveness of the force. And this is the precise results of what happened in this particular case. The trial counsel really didn't argue very much from the victim impact statement and didn't argue any of the comments that the appellant has specifically raised. The trial counsel in this case focused their argument on how the appellant's conduct affected the Air Force, the good order and discipline in the Air Force, and even when he talked about the victim statements, he related it back to how that was spreading a more negative view of the Air Force, how these recruits, that's part of the image of the Air Force, and how they now have disdain and a negative view of it that just further has impacted the harm to the Air Force as well. So the trial counsel throughout his argument tied back everything to A, showing how the appellant seemed to not have proper remorse or appreciate the severity of his offense, and also how this crime has specifically impacted the Air Force. Secondly, in regards to prejudice, the judge's instruction was given twice. It was given right after the victim's impact statements were provided to the members, and then it was given again before the members went to deliberate. And again, the judge empowered the members, he instructed the members that they could give it whatever weight they wanted and they could disregard those statements if they found it to be contradicted by other evidence in the record. A BCD and a reduction in two grades was appropriate and not unreasonable for appellant's two violations of Article 92. Appellant was a mass sergeant in a position of special trust who made sexual advances to his recruits, completely defying the education and training he presented in sentencing to show that he knew better. Unless there's any further questions from the court, I'll briefly conclude.
I'd like you to talk about the strength of the government's case, the defense case, and the materiality, just a little bit more in response to what Mr. Casera argued.
Yes, Your Honor. So the government's case was essentially that you had a 15-year, I believe, mass sergeant who was entrusted in a special duty and completely and flagrantly violated that duty to these recruits and to the Air Force. The defense was able to present or show Mass Sergeant, the appellant's 15-year career. And it's the government's position that, yes, that supported the appellant, but it also cut against the appellant to show the training and the education that this particular appellant had to know better and just completely set that aside and went after his own desires. And so it's the government's position that the government had a strong case. The sentence in this case was reasonable and appropriate for the two specifications for which the appellant was convicted, and there was no prejudice as a result.
Okay, I'd like you to explore a little bit the difference between a written unsworn statement and an oral unsworn statement in terms of materiality and quality of the evidence.
And Your Honor, I don't believe the court has addressed whether there is any real difference between written and oral unsworn. I believe they're given the same weight as far as their presentation. And for ML, I believe, she provided the exact same oral as she did for her written unsworn.
But A1C AS delivered a much shorter and narrower unsworn orally, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. It's the government's position, though, that what she disclosed during that unsworn was essentially the same information that the government would be able to argue with or without her providing that testimony, as because of the specific nature of this offense.
I do have a question about the instruction. I'm still focused on the instruction the judge did give in this case, which we know as practitioners is tailored from the unsworn statement instruction that looks a lot like the instruction the judge gives after an unsworn statement by an appellant, especially if there was issues that the appellant went into that perhaps the law was not allowed to be a consideration of sentencing. Okay. There are aspects of this instruction that talk about the member's responsibility, the sentencing authority's responsibility to consider inherent probability, whether it's supported or contradicted by other evidence, reminding the sentencing authority that you can't cross-examine on this unsworn statement, can be rebutted, et cetera, et cetera. How does that play into these statements that the appellant objects to? In other words, was this instruction sufficient to cover the concerns that appellant now raises on appeal?
And it's the government's position it is sufficient to cover those concerns. The victim has a lawful right under Article 6B and RCM 1001 capital A to provide the statement, just as the appellant has a right to present his unsworn statement, and the instruction properly points out to the members that they can consider the fact that they were not able to cross-examine this witness, it wasn't sworn, and that they can give it the weight they want.
You'd agree with an accused unsworn statement, sometimes the members have to get an additional instruction from the military judge, particularly when it deals with collateral consequences and things like that. Is there a time or a place where a military judge needs to do that with a victim unsworn statement? And I'm not talking about the things that the military judge has to keep out, like Roblero, where you're commenting on the sentence that should be, but something in between there.
Your Honor, I believe in another case, in another scenario, that may be appropriate, but it's the government's position there was nothing in this unsworn statement that required further instruction from the military judge.
Can you give an example about when that would cross the line? We know what those things are when it comes to an accused unsworn statement. Talking about administrative discharge, talking about registering as a sex offender.
And all the examples I can think of, Your Honor, are examples that under Roblero, the military judge would keep out from a victim impact statement.
Very good. Thank you. All right, Appellant's Counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
You may proceed.
Your Honors, this time I'm going to go different. The opposite direction, in fact, I'm going to start with assignment of error two. And I'd like to actually address the court with the question that Judge Lewis just asked, because you asked me a very similar question as to what the military judge's obligation is. And I, in my notes, refer to the Talkington case as a perfect example of that, when the military judge is required to instruct the members that you will not consider whether or not the accused has to register as a sex offender. So for example, in this case, had the had ML gotten on the stand and say, in addition to all of this, the accused sexually molested my child when I allowed him into my house. Well, obviously the military judge has an obligation to tell them, you know, to A, not allow that in, and B, if it comes in without him having a chance to stop it from coming in, an obligation to tell the panel you should under no circumstances consider that. This case poses that exact same situation, while not the extreme example that I just gave you, but the exact same situation in sense of the second side of the Talkington coin, for lack of a better term. It is important to note, Your Honors, that the statements, and I believe it was Judge Lewis that pointed this out, the military judge had not read them ahead of time. These statements were written in advance of trial. That much was made clear by the record. So
what are the particular things to you that indicate they were done before trial? They're not dated. There's nothing like that glaringly obvious. What are the most persuasive things to
Your Honor, I wrote that down in my brief, but that they were written in advance of trial. I forgot to give the court specific examples. But I think certainly by the allegations themselves, I mean by the statements themselves rather, it's pretty clear that what they were referring to was the offenses for which the appellant was found not guilty. And Your Honors both pointed out the statements from ML and from AS that referred to offenses for which the accused was not guilty. Now the government says, well, we don't know why he was acquitted and we don't know what he was convicted of. And that, Your Honors, is the exact problem of this case in a nutshell. We don't know. And if the government doesn't know, and if the military judge at trial didn't know, then certainly the appellant does not know. But it is unlike the responsibilities of the government counsel and the appellant, it is the military judge's responsibility to ensure that A, the appellant knows what he is being convicted of or an accused of, and B, that when a victim impact statement is made, that the military judge only allows that information into a victim impact statement which addresses the offenses for which the appellant was found guilty. One of my very first cases as a trial counsel, Your Honor, I had a client who was accused of murder and an AWOL. He was acquitted of murder. He was found guilty of AWOL. Certainly, the government, under that scenario today, would not be allowed to put on evidence as to the impact of the murder on the alleged, on the victim's family, for example. And I respectfully think that any distinction drawn between that and what happened in this case is a distinction without a difference. Judge Lewis, you also asked the question of whether or not the statement that he was trying to have sex with young, you know, she was wondering whether or not he was trying to have sex with young airmen, whether there was a specific objection required. Your Honor, I think that the case law is pretty clear that a general objection to suffices. And when one objects to the statements coming in and then objects once those statements start to come in, there is not a requirement under the law that he address every single statement that comes in. But even under a world in which that is the case, it is plain error for a military judge to allow testimony or statements that say he did this without my consent, or statements that he is trying to have sex with young airmen when there was no evidence before the court for the offenses of which the appellant was found guilty that those incidents occurred. Are there any further questions as it relates to assignment of error 2? I will briefly address assignment of error 1.
Is the judge permitted to apply a 4-3 balancing test to an unsworn statement given by the victim?
I think the appellant's view is yes, he is. I think that question is left undecided by Hamilton. Your Honors, the government counsel stated that the focus, that the focus of the government or the appellant's case was not on whether or not these offenses these actions were inappropriate. With all due respect, that is not the case. If you look at the appellant's civilian defense counsel's opening statement on page 201, he states, is this appropriate or not? I don't know. They're going to present evidence whether it is. There was no sexual assault. There was no recruitment misconduct relating to the second person. But he continually goes on in his opening statement and says, there is certainly not a concession that this is improper. But the key to this case, Your Honors, I think is really fairly succinct as it relates to the first assignment of error. The question isn't whether or not Master Sergeant De Silva's conduct was inappropriate. If one believes the statements of these young ladies, which we obviously don't as it relates to assignment of error 4, but if one believes the statements of these young ladies, it's inappropriate. Does it violate another regulation? It could well violate, had there been a similar regulation in Pope, where it says creates a hostile work environment, it could very well violate some regulation out there. That's not the issue before this court. The issue is, as this case was charged, was the appellant put on proper notice as to what constitutes a sexual advance? And the answer is, he was not. Your Honor, subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that concludes the appellant's presentation.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you, judges.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.
Well done. Big fun. I